Welcome to Native America Calling from Studio 49 in Albuquerque. I'm Tara Gatewood. A Mohawk First Nation in Canada is marking a 30-year-old land conflict that is still not resolved. On July 11, 1990, a stance against a proposed golf course expansion and condominium project on land significant to the Mohawk erupted into an armed standoff. The action blocked roads for 78 days, and there were a number of violent confrontations. We'll hear about the history from someone who was there. Stay with us.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. After a legal battle spanning a quarter of a century, prominent Native American rights advocate Suzanne Harjo weighs in on finally seeing the Washington NFL team retire its name and logo. Christine Trudeau reports.
In the 88 years, the Washington NFL team has passed its name from owner to owner, so too has resistance to the long-held slur from generation to generation of Native advocates. For Suzanne Harjo, it started in 1962, when activist Clyde Warrior visited her high school class to speak against the University of Oklahoma's mascot, Little Red.
And the worst one is the one in the nation's capital. And he taught us how to articulate that issue, how to make an argument, how to debate it.
An invaluable lesson Harjo carried with her, as other sports mascots have changed, starting in 1970 with Little Red. Throughout continued actions leading up to the 25-year legal battle to change the Washington NFL team name, each generation and advocates like Amanda Blackhorse and many others have each been crucial to changing the name. But Harjo reminds, make no mistake, owner Daniel Snyder's decision came down to money, with FedEx CEO Fred Smith threatening to cash in his shares if the name didn't change.
That was the ball game, and he knew that he had no more time.
From here, says Harjo, it's only a matter of time for other sports leagues' team names to follow suit.
We already won this. As a societal change, we have changed over two-thirds. We've changed over 2,000 of these offensive slurs and cultural appropriations, and now we have a little less than 900 left to go.
In 2014, Harjo was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. I'm Christine Trudeau.
This story is a collaboration with National Native News and the Solutions Journalism Network. Two Native artists from Wisconsin are among this year's National Heritage Fellows presented by the National Endowment for the Arts. Karen Ann Hoffman, recognized for beadwork, and Wayne Valier Sr. builds canoes. Ben Meyer has more.
Wayne Valier Sr. is one of just a handful of master birch bark canoe builders remaining in the Midwest. He's now one of the 9 National Heritage Fellows for 2020, an award which honors folk and traditional arts.
The art forms that I'm known for, they don't belong to me. The knowledge belongs to my people. So that's one of the reasons why I won the award, I guess, is because I've been sharing this canoe culture and communities throughout the Midwest.
Since 1982, Heritage Fellowships have been won by icons like bluesman B.B. King, says Cliff Murphy of the National Endowment for the Arts.
It is intended as the highest honor in the folk and traditional arts bestowed by the United States government.
Murphy points out Valier seeks to teach canoe building while teaching traditional language, skills, and ways of life.
He brings young people into the process to learn how to make canoes. In the process, they're learning about all of these things that are so important to the life ways and identity and sacred practices of this community.
Valier says he's working on another canoe now with an apprentice who will soon become a master canoe builder himself.
If my life work, if I can teach one person to carry this craft forward, then I know that that it'll live for at least one more generation.
For National Native News, I'm Ben Meyer in northern Wisconsin.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Sanoski Chambers Law Firm, championing tribal sovereignty and defending Native American rights since 1976, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Support by BNSF Railway, moving our economy for over 165 years. Our vision is to operate injury and accident-free with safety programs, training, and technology. More at bnsf.com/tribal relations.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. There have been a number of recent turn of events that many see as victories for Native people in the United States, from the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that affirms tribal jurisdiction in Oklahoma, to the decision to change the offensive name and mascot of the Washington NFL team. Those so-called victories came long after a vigorous fight by numerous people, and the outcomes of those fights were never certain. There is an important fight in Canada that this week marks 30 years without a resolution for the Gunasitake First Nation. It is commonly known as the Oka Crisis, and it's over a large tract of land important to the Mohawk Nation. The initial stance to protect the land sparked a 78-day standoff that included the death of a provincial police officer. Today we'll learn more about the history and talk about what happened in the past and perhaps how it can guide some current struggles here in the United States and Canada. If you'd like to share some thoughts, make a comment. The phone number to dial is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And joining us today from Ottawa, Ontario, in Canada, is Wanique Horn Miller. She is a Mohawk Olympian and veteran of the Oka Standoff. And Wanique is Mohawk from Kahnawake. Our pleasure to have her here. Wanique, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Wanique. You know, just seeing some of the footage of this and what happened, I was reminded of so many things that I've witnessed in the past few years. And Wanique, when you describe what happened there in Oka, how do you describe it?
Well, I have a very different perspective just because I was young and, Ellen was, she was older and she's from Gunasitake and she has a very different kind of, well, not very different, but just a different lens in which I was seeing the world at the time. I was 14, pretty much a kid. And as you know, I don't know if you have any kids, but 14-year-olds, you're pretty like self-centered at that time. The world is kind of you, your friends, and all the horrible things of the world. Like, my mom had done a great job and on kind of keeping those at bay. And so when the Oka Crisis broke out July 11th, and I started witnessing all like the race riots and all that stuff that was, kind of boiling out of the seams of Canadian society, it was terrifying, actually. It was really, really scary to see that. But it's also, it was like a fast forward education. Rose-colored glasses were off on what it was like to be an Indigenous person in Canada.
And so describe a little more. I gave, some points on what led to this, but tell us more. Go ahead, Wanique.
Well, I became only involved there because of my mom. I mean, my mom has a long history of activism all the way back into the early 60s here in Canada, also south of the border. She was, spoke at the very, very first AIM conference and extremely involved in Native rights and Native activism. And so when July 11th happened, I remember, early in the morning, it was 5:30 in the morning, being like dragged out of bed by my mom. It was summer vacation. I just got back from the North American Indigenous Games, a couple days earlier. So I was sleeping in, and then I get dragged out of bed, and my mom drives me in front of the TV and she says, they just attacked Gunasadaga. They just attacked. And here I was watching, like, half asleep, watching, you know, the scene that looked like it should have been on the other side of the world, you know, tear gas, gunshots, people running, people yelling, cops in full, I mean, I didn't know they were cops. They could have been, they looked like soldiers because they were fully decked out in, like, riot gear and, like, you know, army gear. And it was happening in our communities. And it was incredible, you know. And, you know, as sort of I slowly dawned on me what was happening, and over the next few days, as the, you know, Ganawage went, blockaded the bridge in support because, you know, we are the same nation and very intermarried. And so we have the big Mercier Bridge that goes from the South Shore of Montreal into Montreal that connects about 500,000 commuters. That was blockaded right away. And Gunnisadaga, they dragged out all that, you know, all the cars and everything got onto the highway and made a huge blockade. And that was the beginning. And I ended up going home first to Ganawage with my mom and my little sister, who was 4 at the time. We went home to Ganawage, and then we ended up in Gunasadaga.
And so from there, Monique, I know that many people started to watch when this, you know, hit the airwaves. And just understanding what it meant to be there, I think, is really important, and the reasons which brought people there. Maybe you remember this. Maybe you know it as the Oka Crisis. If there's anything you'd like to share, you are welcome to join us. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Also here with us today is Ellen Gabriel. She is a veteran of the Oka Crisis, and she is Mohawk. Our pleasure to have her here as well. Ellen, welcome.
Hello.
And Ellen, I take it to you to take us back to the things that led up to this. And how do you like to tell the story?
Well, I call it the Gunasadaga Siege. Oka is the colonial imposed name upon our community, which we're still battling. And we have lost so much land because we're not a typical reserve in Canada's laws. So it's a checkerboard. So you have Mohawk, Quebecois, Mohawk, Quebecois. And so it's not a contiguous reserve in the traditional sense. So this piece of property or this piece of land included our cemetery. My parents and a lot of my family and you know, communities, families have been burying people for centuries. This was going to be dug up to extend the parking lot of the golf course. And so we blocked a secondary dirt road. It's not a highway. It was, you could still go through it if you were from the community. And if you weren't, we tried to educate people. So from March 9th on to those few months where we were still trying to peacefully negotiate some kind of settlement with the government, the mayor of Oka seemed to have a lot of pull and influence in powerful places. And he ordered the Cité du Québec, which is and this particular force that came to us was a paramilitary force. The Cité du Québec was the first police entity in North America to have paramilitary training. And so they came, and they came at 5:15 in the morning. And what people forget is that it was the women that went to the front, because the women are the title holders to the land. So there were 13 of us that went, and we endured concussion grenades and tear gas. And we went up there and tried to negotiate with them for at least 50 minutes to leave, and they refused. And so the women had already gone to the front when a lot of the community members started coming in. And so people forget the fact that there were 13 brave women that sort of addressed these guys, this paramilitary force who had their guns pointed at our heads and our hearts. And after about 3 hours of negotiating with them, they opened fire on us. And the bullets we see in the pine trees are at the head and heart level. And a lot of us are very lucky to be alive because we saw the bullets and heard the bullets flying by us. And it started what is called the 78-day siege, or the 78-day crisis, Oka crisis. But we were denied our fundamental human rights, the right to food, water, medicines, all those kinds of things. And we were the ones that were the criminals. And yet we know who the real criminals are, which is the government of Canada, the British, the French, and the Seminary of St. Sulpice.
And for you, Ellen, what message was being sent by the reaction from those outside of the Native community?
You mean the public, or are you talking about the government?
I think both.
It was a mixture. I mean, there was actually French sovereignists who were supporting us. They were protesting daily, if not weekly basis, in front of the Premier of Quebec, the late Robert Bourassa's office in Montreal. And they were talking, like, before we talk about our sovereignty, we need to recognize the sovereignty of the Native people. You know, back then, 30 years ago, this is how people talked. There were protests right across Canada, and you know, and not just on the reserves, but in the cities and urban areas. And we did get a lot of support publicly, because even the government was throwing the ball to everybody. Somebody blamed the secretary for the justice minister to order the raid. Justice ministers kind of like, I don't know what happened, but obviously somebody had some pull to have such a strong use of force against a peaceful barricade. And then what happened was the SQ, after the shootout, they kind of ran down the hill and gifted us with their vehicles. So someone from the community got in the payloader. People started, you know, cutting trees down as a protective barricade. And that's the first time we actually blocked the road. But actually, it's the Circuit Quebec that blocked the road. And for those months, those days, it was really very difficult. People felt safer behind the barricades because of the racism that was going on outside. People being beaten in Chateauguay, the sister community in Ganawaga. There was effigies of Mohawk men being burnt and hung near a gas station in Chateauguay. People were more concerned about the inconvenienced motorists rather than the lives of the Kanyakahag, the Mohawk people. And a problem that was created by government that could have been settled 300 years ago.
And it's so interesting that a lot of what was fueling this moment extends back that far. And when you think about some of the things and the way they're positioned, you know, makes me think of others. We'll continue. Hang tight. Minneapolis was the epicenter of a revolt against ongoing oppression of people of color after the death of George Floyd. Native organizations are among those caught up in the chaos. We'll hear from some that are now hoping to promote healing. That's on the next Native America Calling.
Native America Calling is supported by Oregon State University eCampus. Eddie Rodriguez knows what college is like as a member of a minority community. And as a first-generation college graduate, he knows what it takes to succeed. Now he's a student success coach for Oregon State eCampus, eager to help Native American students like you earn your degree online. Read Eddie's story at ecampus.oregonstate.edu/eddie.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and today we are learning about what happened 30 years ago this week when hundreds of Mohawks barricaded an area known as the Pines in Quebec, Canada, and the lands hold great significance to the tribe and the opposed plans for a golf course expansion and condominiums. And if you want to join our conversation today, any thoughts on any of this? Does it sound like something you've faced in your own tribal community or lands that are sacred to your nation? Go ahead and give us a ring. We look forward to hearing from you. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And with us today are two women who were at this place. They are both Mohawk. Ellen Gabriel is with us today, as well as Wanique Horn Miller. Ladies, thank you both for being here with us. And Ellen, I go back to you, and you were talking about you know, just what the positions were and some of the reactions from others. And Ellen, during those times and what people were discussing, maybe even inside the camp and the people who were there at the standoff, what was some of the sentiment? What were their thoughts on why it was important to take this stance?
Well, it was actually not a camp. It was, if you're talking about the blockade before that, but it was, you know, community, a whole community. And the position was that we'd lost a lot of land, and this was what's called common land. And we're being, when we still are, being squeezed into smaller and smaller pieces of land to eke out a living. So what's what people thought, well, maybe if they pay us for the land, then they're lost. And we did a community radio survey, and everybody, 100%, said, no, we can't accept money because it doesn't replace the loss. You can never put a value to the loss of land. So the position was, yeah, let's keep up the barricades in spite of 3 injunctions against us by the municipality of Oka. And during the summer, it was very difficult because people were afraid. We were outgunned, outnumbered, out-resourced. And people, you have to remember, it's a community, so people have their families. There's elders who didn't want to leave. They remained in their homes even after the Canadian Army occupied our community. And, you know, people being who they are, we were dealing with vandalism from some of our own people. Some of the people who are called heroes because they were caught in the treatment center, these guys. So there's a lot of there's a lot of strife even inside, simply because of the pressure from the outside and the threat that they would come in and wipe us out. So it was normal for people to be afraid, and it was really tense. I have to be honest, I wasn't sure if any of us would get out alive, and even if we did, what would happen, which was, you know, having lived through and stayed in this community since then, it's been very trying. It's been very difficult because we got blamed for something that we did not create.
And Ellen, the ties to this area are really important. And, you know, it starts off with a lot of deception from colonizers. Any thoughts on that, or just sharing people, you know, more history on some of that deception?
Well, Ganasagaga is the oldest community, the oldest existing Ganyakahaga communities. It remained, it existed pre-European arrival. And we are challenging the assumed sovereignty of Canada and its provinces over our territory because of the doctrine of discovery. These racist, morally reprehensible, and condemned by the United Nations doctrines upon which Canada and other colonizers justify the land dispossession of our people and pushing and squeezing us into smaller places and you know, with Indian residential schools threatening our languages. So there's so many issues tied to the land. You know, the land is part of who we are. The land is our language is based on the land, and the culture is based on the land. So it's extremely important. And the fact that there are thousands, if not millions, of generations that have walked here before, for us, we need to continue the fight because there has been no justice. There's been no relief. You know, we went through all this 30 years ago, and we're still fighting the exact same issues on the land protection as we did 30 years ago.
And Winique, I toss it to you. You were a young person during all this. What was shared with you of how important it was to be on that land at that moment?
Well, I mean, you understand this from, like, being told and being explained, you know, by elders, by your parents, by your family, the importance of land. And then you see, like, that summer, you see the first of all, you see the very different perspectives of that tie to land. Like, what I really saw, you know, from my own people was that they were not willing. Like, they were willing to give up everything. They were willing to die for the land. That was how ferociously protective of the land we are. And it's this different concept of connection to the land that was really evident, you know. And I think it was really important for me, you know, as a 14-year-old, to really see, you know, like Ellen talked about the fear and how people felt safe behind, you know, the barricades. It was true. I remember when we first got to Ganawage, and the first place they took us up was on the Mercier Bridge. And, you know, you look down the binoculars and you see all this, you know, the Sûreté de Québec, you see the RCMP, you see the cops, all these people and all these, like, people and guns pointed at us. And, you know, I'm surrounded by all these, you know, all the Mohawk men, everybody up there, and they're all looking and they're all, like, you know, as in usual Native fashion, laughing, joking around, but serious. And you know what? They were willing, like, they were willing to do whatever it took to protect the land, but also our people. And, you know, I did feel safer knowing that I was amongst my own people and that this was something that is an age-old fight, and an age-old fight to protect the land and to protect our nation, to protect who we are. And, you know, it was coming to play with, you know, understanding the real racism that exists in Canada, that had, you know, Canada loves to say how, you know, what a human rights, you know, champion they are around the world, yet in their own backyard, this is what was happening, these race riots and the cops doing nothing to stop it, not doing nothing to stop the stoning of elders' cars as they left the community. This was seen nightly. And, you know, to this day, you haven't had an apology or any sort, even for that kind of behavior. It was really extremely damaging to the relations between our two communities, and terrifying as a 14-year-old to see people hating you and wanting to get at you, not because something you did, it was because of who I was and where I was from. So all of this was it was an important awakening for me as a young person to understand who I was and sort of what part of my responsibility was.
And Monique, with that said, does anything what you're seeing in the media, happening in the States or places around the world, remind you of what you went through?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's always coming back. I mean, you have the fight for the Dakota Access, you know, to stop the pipelines in North Dakota. You have, and the use of extreme force. You have the Wet'suwet'en, blockades to stop the expansion of that pipeline. I mean, these are all instances of Indigenous people trying to protect their land and the right, you know, to decide and all these things. And the threat of violence. And that's the thing, is that, you know, you don't evoke a relationship of trust when you throw violence at it. And these are two strongly different perspectives on how to create nationhood, right? Like, you have the very Eurocentric way. Well, we're bigger and scarier, and we'll make you do what you're going to do. Well, you know what? They've been trying that for hundreds and hundreds of years, and we're still here, and we haven't forgotten, you know. And it's really evident, you know, it's evident in that kind of, you know, that brokenness between that relationship. And then down in the States, you know, with all the Black Lives Matter movement and the use of the military, you know, really, really horrific use of the military against peaceful protesters is really, you know, reminds me of that. And when the army rolled into both of our communities. And, you know, in Canada, we kind of, you know, a lot of Canadians, you hearing them say, oh, look at the Americans, like, they're, you know, look at Trump, look what he's doing. Isn't that horrible? I'm like, well, wait a second. You did that. This country did that. And no one screamed the top of their lungs that this was wrong. And we were called terrorists in the House of Commons and all this kind of declared terrorists. All this stuff. So, you know, yes, of course, it's a reminder. But, you know, what is also a reminder to me is that, you know, there's so much work to be done. And it's super important that the world, and especially this country, never forgets what happened. Because if you do forget, then you have the chance of making that mistake again.
Thank you for that, Monique. And again, if you want to join us, 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And maybe this is sparking some memories that you had. Maybe you watched some of this unfold 30 years ago. What are your thoughts today? 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Ellen, I turn to you. Are you seeing reflections as well?
Well, I live it every day when I see the kind of development that's still going on that we've been trying to stop. I think what is really frustrating is that even when we try peaceful means, they just go ahead and bulldoze down those efforts. There's a difference between the Band Council, which is a Government of Canada created entity, which has very little power until the Minister of Indian Affairs can actually rubber stamp any kind of policy or things like that. And the traditional Haudenosaunee, the Longhouse government, which survived colonization and still exists today, long before any Europeans set foot here, we are being silenced, we are being ostracized, criminalized. Our personal reputations are being undermined by our own people with the help of government. And so when I see what's going on today and I see the exact same thing that happened in 1990 with Band Council and the traditional people, I think that, you know, what the lessons are is that colonization dug in its heels, repackaged their brand, and they've made it more palatable for people to accept colonization and assimilation. They pretend that they are, like Winique said, defenders of human rights, but not for Indigenous people. It's evident through all the violations they have of their own constitutions, their rule of law, and their denial to uphold the highest standards, even just the minimum standards of human rights obligations, like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the committee, the Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, the Convention for Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. You know, we are the title holders to the land, but we are being excluded from any discussions on land. So, I see that, you know, the physical barricades came down in 1990, September 26, or a few weeks after, but we're still living the same thing. I still feel like, we don't have the increased presence of the police and army anymore, but nothing has changed. It's still the same.
And with that, you know, moving into these times, what more needs to be done? Maybe you want to answer that. Go ahead and dial in. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Let's go ahead and hear from our listening audience. Again, if you want to join us, 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We have Colleen in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Colleen, thank you for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to say that your speaker made very good points and about racism in the past, and I think examples of racism today are, even at the national level, is the degree to which people are still trying to undo what the work of the previous president, and that's all entirely race-based. And I think that the deconstruction of structures that support is an example of institutionalized racism. She was talking about the denial to uphold highest standards in human rights. And so I think you asked the question, what more can be done? And I think instead of focusing on just decolonizing, it also needs to be about starting to re-indigenize. And that's where you exist without having to refer to the oppressor to exist. And so you learn and you come into your own and understand your own cultures and how the survival of that happened. Because as a student of sacred calendar, we're in the year 8 Flint, which is a year of sacrifice. And if you look to the Mayan codices and you find 8 Flint, take a look at the pictures. Don't even look at the words that are translated, and just look. And what does that imagery mean to you? If the past can be reflected in the future according to Indian time and the ways that we knew back then go take a look for yourself and find out more about your cultures, because we're coming up to the end of the 52-year cycles in about 12, 13 years. So that's all I want to say. Less than 20 years. Sorry.
All right, Colleen, thank you for your call here in Albuquerque. Ellen, anything you want to share after hearing that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of richness in our culture that we need to draw on, and I think that's what we've drawn on to continue this battle, because it's not easy. And the problem is that when you're stuck in survival mode all the time, you're just basically reacting. And a lot of our people are asleep, and I'm sure the previous caller, I think her name was Colleen, would also agree with that. Our people are sleeping. We are living in times where we're trying to protect our lands and protect our human rights, but also living in climate change times where what kind of legacy are we leaving behind? And that includes, what kind of land is left behind. There's estimates by UN scientists or scientists that say we may have 20 to 30 years when it becomes so extreme. And so people will be fighting for food. So all those teachings from our ancestors are extremely important to carry on. But for me, where I'm living, I almost got run over by a big truck bringing in gravel. He refused to let me wait to get into my car, almost ran me over. It's not the first incident we have at confronting these people who are stealing our land. And so we're stuck in survival mode. It's like reacting. And I wish more of our people would be more aware of those teachings, so there would be more people fighting and more people pushing back on the theft, the fraud of our land to preserve for future generations to enjoy.
Well, thank you for that. Ellen Gabriel, Winnie Korn Miller are both here with us a full hour. If you'd like to share some thoughts, go ahead and dial in. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We look forward to your calls and maybe even reflections. And of course, if there is something that you're hearing in the stories that you're hearing today from both of these women that is reflecting something you saw recently, you can share some thoughts too. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We look forward to hearing from you today. Again, these phone lines, while they're open, give us a call.
Support by Southwestern Indian Polytechnic Institute's Early Childhood Education Program, providing an affordable pathway for the next generation of Native teachers who will meet the unique educational needs of Native students. SIPI's Early Childhood Education Associate's Degree is an all-inclusive program with mentorship for success in education in an intertribal learning community. Info and application at sipi.edu under Academics, then Programs. Fall application deadline is August 7th.
Thanks for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. And before we get back to our conversation, here's something else that's going on. There is a project with our affiliated music program in Digify that highlights Native artists. Here is a quick preview of one of the podcast episodes, which are available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Alexis Salee, host and producer of Indigify. I'm excited to share with you the release of the Native Artist Podcast from Indigify. The Native Artist Podcast gives listeners access to established and emerging Native artists as they share their unique stories and perspectives, the mindset behind the art, and how they're navigating these fields while reclaiming Native identity. Here's a clip from our conversation with contemporary artist Tristan Uggonorik Morgan.
I'm named after my great-grandma, Rosie. It's really interesting kind of learning about the naming process of Anipaq people and how you take on the personality of the person that you're named after. I knew very little of my Mau Rosie, but as far as I'm concerned, what people have told me, she was incredibly strong-willed and she was a master skin sewer. She was an artist and she was very stern and very outspoken. And I feel like I have grown into that. When I reconnected, that was the family member that I looked to. That's something that I'm able to really hold on to, especially having her as the person I'm named after.
Listen to the full conversation by subscribing to the Native Artist Podcast today, available in the Apple Podcasts app or anywhere podcasts are available. Funding provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and support by Bristol Bay Native Corporation. Find out more at nativeartistpodcast.com.
This is Native America Calling. We're live, and we are talking about a standoff that happened 30 years ago in Quebec, Canada, on Mohawk territory. If you'd like to comment, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848 is the number. With us today are two women who are there. If you want to talk directly to them, we have Ellen Gabriel with us and Wanique Horn-Miller. Again, phone lines are open, 1-800-996-2848. We now go to the phone lines. We have Joseph, who is in Bethel, Alaska, tuned in on KYUK. Joseph, thank you for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Good morning. How are you guys doing today?
We are hanging in there. And what are you thinking today, Joseph?
Well, you know, as far back as we come from and everything we stood for, we always made a stand and try to make a difference for every culture, no matter what country we've come from. And it's good to see all these people standing up for what they believe in and make a stand and let people know that we can't take the sitting down and thinking people can walk all over us. If we don't take a stand and do what we believe in, it just makes it harder for everybody else that's trying to make an effort to show what they can do for their own culture.
Well, Joseph, thank you for sharing. Thank you for your call there out of Bethel. We now go to the Lakotere Ojibwe community in Wisconsin. We have Daryl, who's tuned in on WOJB. Daryl, thank you for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Hello, I just have a comment. What needs to be done is set every person down in front of a mirror and look at themselves and ask themselves, one, who gets to pick their parents? Two, who gets to pick their color? No one I have ever met. So if we the people would teach our children this, I believe that could be a first step to start a communal conversation about race, not only.
All right, Daryl, thank you for your call there in Lakotere. We now go to Gary, who's in Bradford, Pennsylvania, tuned in online. Gary, what you thinking?
Good afternoon, ladies. I'm very frustrated. You know, I remember, I'm not Native, but I find it frustrating that Native Americans are still going through all this horseshit after all these years.
Yeah. All right, Gary, I feel your passion, but we can't have profanity on air. Here we are, years later, and yes, we are still seeing a lot of this. And Wanique, I go to you, because if you Google what happened there on Mohawk land 30 years ago, your name might come up in a photo that seemed to go around the world. I'd like you to explain a little bit what led up to that moment and anything you want to share. I know this weighs heavy on your heart, and please share whatever you feel comfortable with. Wanique?
Well, I mean, that picture really became one of the ones that has been used quite a bit when you speak about or when people are referring to Mohawk resistance or the Oka Christ or whatever you're going to call it. But, that when that photo was taken, it was September 26, 1990. There had been negotiations that the decision to leave the treatment center where we were held up at the end, where there had been, we had been encircled by the army, thousands of troops. I think the number was they sent more to Gunasadaga and Gunawaga than they sent to, they've sent to Afghanistan, but that they sent more troops to our communities than overseas. And the decision was made after the bridge, the Mercier Bridge, was the decision over there was made to give that up to let it open again. And I'm not sure that the decisions behind that or why that was decided, but we had to come up with what we were going to do. And I mean, there was discussions, we're going to shoot our way out, where, there was a lot of anger and a lot of, there was also a lot of fear about what do we do when we come out, how are they going to treat us, right? The army had sent some of the most racist units to be right there front and center. They didn't send peaceful. Some of the soldiers there were just like, they went on to actually be disbanded because of their racism and killings that happened overseas in Somalia. So These units were, you know, trained to be that way. And so when the decision was made, it was about 5:30 in the evening. We were preparing to leave. The sun was going down. We did our ceremonies, and the women and children were put at the front because they were afraid that if we were intermixed with everybody, then they might mistake us for adults. And I know that they were going to go after specific people, specific warriors that they wanted. And as we were getting ready to leave, to go out the front gates of the treatment center and then be loaded onto buses and taken to a military prison, the army pushed the media barricade back about like a few hundred meters. And because the sun was going down, and the media didn't see what was going to happen, we were afraid that, you know, a shot would be fired and then suddenly we'd all be killed and no one would see it, right? So rather than go out the front gates, we marched up to the front and then took a right turn along the barbed wire to a corner where there was only two levels of barbed wire, because everywhere else was three levels. And someone had a spinal board, and that they put it on top of the barbed wire, and people started to pour out on, like, out onto the highway. And at that time, the army was yelling, hey, you know, they were, and it, like, kind of chaos all broke loose. And I had my little sister who was four, and I had her in my hand, and she was pretty calm up until that point. And as people were flying by, grabbing the other kids, trying to get them down the hill, at least as close as possible to the media barricade so that we would be seen, my little sister, there was a soldier standing in front of us, and he was a young non-Native guy holding this big, big gun. And he was kind of standing there as this, like, they were jumping other people. People were in the ditches. They were, like, grabbing people and just really chaotic. And he just stood there. And I remember my little sister looked at him and she saw his gun, and she started to make this sound that was, you know, will forever haunt me for the rest of my life, because now that I'm a mother, I know the sounds that children make. I know the sounds of I'm scared, I'm hungry, I'm tired, but there's a very, very, very scary sound that a child makes when they think they're going to die, like the absolute terror scream that they make. And she started to make that sound, and I looked at her and I looked at him and I said, he's not going to hurt you. He won't hurt you. And I put my hand on his chest and I pushed him backwards. And he actually let us walk by him. Like he stood back and let us walk by, and we walked out onto the highway. And when we got to the highway, I got intercepted by another soldier, and I kept fighting and fighting and fighting my way, trying to get as close as possible to the media barricade. And when I got there, I recognized a soldier there, a major that about 2 weeks earlier I had had an argument with over the barbed wire, saying he didn't want to allow my grade 10 school books in. So I said, I recognize you. And I kind of pulled my little sister behind me. And at that very moment, I pointed at him. At that moment, I got hit in the chest. And I didn't know, like, it was more like when you get hit in the chest, you get the wind knocked out of you. And I fell forward, and my little sister put her arms around my neck. And then someone pulled, like my feet were suddenly out from underneath me, and I was on my back on the highway. And I don't have a clear memory of that happening. I remember it in snapshots. And I never understood why. I didn't understand why I couldn't remember it as a clear, consistent memory. It was like snap, snap. I could see up above me. I could see feet. I could see cameras. I could see cameras flashing. I could see a soldier. I could see guns, but not a consistent memory. And many years later, when I finally got therapy, my therapist said, well, that's what happens when your mind is in acute stress. It will either shut down or it will break. And your mind was probably trying to preserve itself, because I do remember how I felt. I remember when that photo was taken, I felt so much anger and pain and fear and rage and sadness. Like, I felt my whole body was going to explode with it. And you can see it on my face when you see that picture. And after that picture was taken, someone dragged me by the back of my jacket, like under the collar of my jacket, dragged me and my sister, my little sister who was on top of me, all the way back to where they had encircled all the other, a lot of the other Mohawks, including my mother. And found my mother, I gave my little sister to her. And then I looked down and my slit was covered in blood. And I didn't know that the order had been given to put bayonets on the ends of their weapons. And they're still trying to say that it was an accident, that my stabbing was an accident. And I was told this recently by a French reporter from Radio Canada. And I went, how can it be an accident if someone gave the order to put bayonets on the ends of their weapons and then shove them at you? Like, I don't know what that is. Accidentally, I walked into it, apparently. So, yeah, so that's how that photo, that picture was taken. And we were taken to a military prison, put on buses, and I didn't get to see any medical treatment for about 22 hours later.
And Monique, do you know what happened to the person who assaulted you?
You know what? No. And I did take my case to the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, and I lost. It was me against the Canadian Armed Forces, and they said that because of my state when it happened, because I was in such acute duress, I couldn't distinctly say that man did it. So basically, I lost my human rights case. But I was unarmed, and I was holding my sister at the time. So apparently in Canada, it's not a violation of human rights if you stab somebody, you know, holding a child. Because they said, well, they offered me medical treatment. They offered me medical treatment when we finally got processed at the military prison, but it was either they were going to charge me at the same time as a 14-year-old that could have been charged with adult charges. And the lawyer said to me, you know, we got to get you out of here. If they get their eyes on you, they're going to charge you, and then you're in a lot of trouble. So the human rights lawyers that were able to help us said they snuck me out quickly. But that was after many, many hours sitting on a bus in the middle of a yard with spotlights on us. So, yeah, I don't know what happened to him. And I can tell you, many years later, 10 years to be exact, when I was, you know, walking to the opening ceremonies of the Olympics, that was the first person I said, I hope you're watching me. And I hope that you know that I defied you and I lived and I went on to succeed. Because I can't imagine doing that to a child. I can't imagine what type of person or what has gone through that person's mind. And I've had to find a place in my heart to forgive, because you can't hold on to that kind of rage for the rest of your life. And I think in a way I haven't forgotten, but just find a place of compassion that is part of how I was raised traditionally. So, but it's always been something that's really been hard to do.
And, you know, sharing your story, I really appreciate it. And going back to a very traumatic moment and, you know, these times for both of you. And I think, for me, right now, the big lesson is to really pay attention to what happens, and knowing that here we are 30 years later, and we've heard it even in our callers saying that we're still seeing similar things, is when we pay attention to these different things that are happening, especially to our Indigenous nations, when they're making those stances, there are lessons. And, you know, when we think about everything and how it connects, and thinking about how do we move forward? Well, maybe moving forward is thinking about what we have endured in the past. Ladies, I appreciate the journey you both have taken us on today. Ellen Gabriel, Winnie Korn Miller, thank you for joining us today. And that's going to wrap up our program. If there's anything you missed in our conversation, it's okay, because you can find it on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. And you can also see past programs too. We really appreciate what you are witnessing during these times too. Maybe you just want to reach out, share some thoughts. You can always reach us, comments@NativeAmericaCalling.com. I'm your host, Tara Gatewood. Thank you for joining us today for another one of our discussions. Tomorrow, we'll sign back on air and invite you into this conversation to share your thoughts and let us know what is important to your Indigenous nation, and even just nations that are connecting to us, and why these conversations are important. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Tara Gatewood. We'll be right back.
smoking gave me COPD, which makes it harder and harder for me to breathe. I have a tip for you. If your doctor gives you 5 years to live, spend it talking with your grandchildren. Explain to them that your grandpa's not going to be around anymore to share his wisdom and his love. I haven't figured out how to do that yet. I'm running out of time.
COPD makes it harder and harder to breathe and can cause death. You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Yat e nga Indian Health Service bilnahas ago British Clergy Basel in bilnahas ago 18 hits is ba hayani gi ICA go ya ya hansen akodi aja ya ahilan del na sto and ya bilan dal na son hayat e at on the best och on not nel that happening in the dash kitlens and go healthcare.gov it is best in the case of be it ajik ahna gi ya 1-800-318-2596 a message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services ahya.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.